is Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And I always like to remind you the number, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Their location, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And of course, you can also reach them via the digital media at Harvell and, spell out the word and please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil and Wes, good afternoon to the two of you.
Afternoon, Lockwood.
Yes, good afternoon, Lockwood.
So the topic today.
Let's kind of explore and decipher, if you will, Lockwood, the concept of capacity to make out testamentary documents, undue influence in and around the signature of documents, including maybe potentially a deed transfer, a contract. So right out of the gate, Lockwood, Wes and I would both affirm that, you know, one does need capacity to sign a legal document, to enter into a contract, to sign a deed, to enter into a trust agreement. And this in the law is known as, you know, capacity. And of course, like so many areas of the law, the devil is in the details as to whether or not at the time someone is signing a document, do they have the capacity to do so? Are they under the undue influence of alcohol or drugs or a terminal illness? Do they advanced age, dementia? All of these issues are the kinds of things that Wes and I hear, you know, on a daily basis in terms of people signing documents. We at our office, of course, are, and I think, and I hope most lawyers are very careful about this issue. I mean, there are times that we need to meet with the client more than on one occasion. There are times that we would like to have a simple statement from a physician or a hospital note that Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones has the ability to sign legal documents in the opinion of the medical professional. It's just something that needs to be considered from time to time. Also, circumstances. Are Wes and I traveling out to the home place of the person who's about to make a signature? Are we seeing them in the hospital? And if we're in the hospital, under what circumstances? Are we seeing them in the, you know, the intensive care unit, or are we seeing them out on the floor a day or two before they are leaving to go home? The nursing facilities, all of these factors would be factors if unfortunately, the document were challenged and we end up in a court of law listening to all of the witnesses and looking at the medical records and discerning whether or not the person had the capacity to enter into the document. And so, you know, this is just something, Lockwood, that we should talk about, and that's going to be the issue of the day.
You know, the interesting aspect about this, Cecil, and we've talked about this on numerous occasions, is issue of, you know, witnesses and things of this nature, having multiple observations about the individual or the circumstances. Are witnesses pretty important in this particular case?
Lockwood, they are.
Okay, Wes, you can take that one.
Sure. You know, it depends on the document. You know, when you say witnesses, witnesses is a term of art to us attorneys because, you know, a witness, like, for example, to a will, I mean, in a will, you have to have two disinterested witnesses, meaning people who are not interested in the outcome or how the assets pass under the will. So that's a term of art. Who are your witnesses? Okay, who are the witnesses? All the witness really has to do is to actually watch the person sign the document.
Okay.
Okay, they're not really there for the purpose of making a determination as to whether the person has capacity or doesn't have capacity. So in some cases, for example, let's say a document is signed in a lawyer's office. The lawyer may have gone through the document with the person, explained the document, had conversation with the person, talked about the person's family, his assets, you know, so on and so forth, and then the witnesses just come in to watch the signing.
Uh-huh.
So they may not be in a position at all where they have an opinion with regard to the person's capacity. However, you know, whenever we are in these cases that are, you know, based on undue influence or lack of capacity, and whether a document, whether it's a deed or a will or whatever it may be, is valid, the witnesses are normally witnesses in the litigation.
Mm-hmm.
They're normally people that we want to depose. Okay. They're normally people that we want to ask questions of, because they may certainly have been involved to an extent where they were able to discern and determine, you know, to their satisfaction whether the person had capacity or not.
Right.
It just depends from one situation to the next. As it relates to a deed, you don't have to have witnesses at all. That's not required. You know, the signature needs to be notarized in order for the document to be recorded, and it needs to be recorded, you know, for it to be, you know, a valid deed. There's a lot of nuances there with regard to it being a valid deed, but
right.
Generally speaking, it needs to be recorded. So
let's pause right there. I like that word, notary. A document that is notarized does not mean that at the time that the signature, the person making the signature, had capacity. That is not the duty of a notary to determine or even have an opinion as to capacity. This comes up quite often, but it's kind of a six and half a dozen of another in terms of conversation. I mean, the duty of the notary is to assure themselves that the person who is signing the document, whether or not they have capacity, is in fact the person signing the document. Let me see your driver's license.
Okay.
What kind of identification do you have? You are Mr. Jones, correct? Yes, I am. You know, and to make sure that the authenticity of the signature is what the notary duties are all about. Is the signature authentic? Is it in fact the signature of Mr. Jones? Was he the one who signed the document? In other words, it helps with the word forgery.
Right.
Notaries.
Right.
Okay, it's difficult for a forger to forge a document in front of a notary if the notary is doing a good job. But in terms of capacity, it's not up to the notary to interview the person making the signature, ask questions about their what kind of day are you having, what kind of medications are you on, what does your doctor have to say about your prognosis, things of that nature. That is not the responsibility of the notary. Now, with that said, and Wes will tell you that sometimes we have notaries that have an opinion, and they also will assert their opinion under the circumstances and potentially become a witness whereby they have an opinion about capacity. But that's why I said six of one, half a dozen of another. It, however, though, is not the duty of the notary to determine capacity.
You know, I go back to my question then on the issue of the witnesses, in regards to the possibility of a challenge, and I'm also curious about that. And again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station on the issue of capacity and that issue of competence and undue influence. But Wes, at the same time, in the case where you as an attorney might have some you may know of a potential conflict within the family, for example. Does it not benefit to also have some external observers, I use that word external, meaning others that are not necessarily directly related to the activity of the communications between the lawyer and the client? Is that helpful in that case? Is that something that times you predetermine, I shouldn't say predetermined, but you think about ahead of time?
Yeah, I mean, the more witnesses you can have, the better. I mean, you know, really the way to kind of eliminate the problem.
Right.
And the problem that Cecil and I are talking about here is when a document gets signed by someone who is either lacks the capacity to sign the document, or is under the influence of someone else at the time they're signing the document, and that influence can come over months and years of, you know, someone working on someone to get them to sign it. The way to eliminate that problem would be let's make sure we sign our documents in circumstances that really aren't questionable, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not wait too late. Because, and let's back into that for a second, because if you wait too late, meaning if you wait shortly before the person dies, well, that kind of raises, in my mind, a presumption that, well, we waited so late because that's really not what this person would have been willing to do when they were strong. So there was an effort here to get them to do what maybe someone else wanted them to do once they got weak and to the point where they really didn't understand completely or were not strong enough, you know, to stand up to the influence.
Right, right.
So if we go, if folks listening out there know that, okay, I want to do this in my will, I want to do this by deed, I think I want to transfer this property in a certain way, but I want to, you know, make sure I do it the right way, go ahead and get with a good attorney. And, you know, and I'm not really saying that for purposes of churning up business. That's
right,
not
right.
Really at all what I'm doing. I mean, the reason I wasn't on the radio last week is because I was in a 7-day jury trial over a deed that was signed 16 days before a man died.
Whoa.
And I was representing the children
mm-hmm.
in a challenge relative to that deed. And, you know, the cost of going to an attorney and having that deed prepared would have been in the hundreds of dollars. It wouldn't have been very much. I can guarantee you a 7-day jury trial doesn't cost hundreds of dollars.
Right.
It was very expensive. And that was, there were circumstances in that case that really raised a lot of concern with regard to whether this person had the capacity. He had serious medical conditions. He died 16 days later. It was signed in the home. The attorney never spoke with him at all. The attorney
Whoa.
Was called by the person who wanted the deed for her benefit. She got it from the attorney, took it to him, and then testified that the attorney had spoken with him. The attorney testified, I never spoke with him. So there were a lot of circumstances there. And let's put all those together. Well, number one, they waited way too late, okay, 16 days before he died. So that raises that kind of presumption in your mind, that red flag. And number two, all these other circumstances with regard to being signed in the home. He never spoke with the attorney. Did he really know what he was signing? So, you know, do yourself a favor. Don't wait so late. And let's do everything really kind of in a very transparent, open way so that we would have, for example, a good attorney to be able to say, well, yeah, I sat down with him. He was doing fine. He was able to explain to me his family, his assets, how the deed operated, and then we don't get into this problem. So that's the way to avoid, you know, the situation of a document that, I mean, and again, these documents are very important. They convey, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of property, depending on the circumstances. That's the way we avoid the problem of potentially a challenge to a document, you know, because of undue influence or lack of capacity. So that's kind of jumping to the end of the conversation there, but that's what people really need to take away from this. Make sure you don't end up in that situation. But sometimes there are folks out there with nefarious intent, Lockwood, and they're wanting to take advantage of the person. And these are all the hallmarks of folks who take advantage of someone. Wait to the last second.
Right.
Make sure if I can get a lawyer to do it, and the lawyer does it, and I can take it to the person, fine. Or maybe I'll print this deed off the internet, and that'll work. You know, so if things don't smell quite right, if they don't look quite right, then, you know, you may be exposing yourself to in your document to a challenge at some point.
One of the things that comes to mind when you were telling us about a few moments ago about the court case that you were engaged in last week, not only the financial cost, but the emotional cost to the family, those that are feeling harmed and engaged in the dispute. That is also something that I think that we should be concerned with as well. And back to your point, it is a matter, and as you said oftentimes, Cecil, the devil is in the details. We've got to get the details. What are some of the protections regarded to the aspect of guaranteeing that there is no undue influence or competency issues, or that the individual has the capacity.
Okay, Lockwood, we've kind of danced around capacity generally, contracts, offers and offers to sell property, deeds, of course, any kind of bill of sale, a transfer document. But of course, you know, the elephant in the room, is it not, is always that, quote, last will and testament.
Mm-hmm.
And as to the last will and testament, there are very specific capacity elements that every lawyer would know about. And they are basically, Lockwood, we've talked about them before. I want to go through them kind of quickly because I want to tell you a scenario that answers your question, Lockwood. But the person needs to understand who their family is. That mm-hmm. is many times known in the law as the objects of their bounty. But who are the members of the family? What is the nature of their property? Where is their property? Is it land? Is it a mobile home? Is it a commercial piece of property? What is the nature of their liquidity? Are there stocks, bonds, bank accounts? They do not have to know the balances. They don't have to have the actual name of the bank, to be absolutely correct, because the banks are constantly changing their names. I mean, you know, that kind of detail is not necessary. It's the nature and the extent of their property, mm-hmm. generally the nature and extent. And then, of course, the effect of the document, the fact that the document that they're signing is going to have the effect of transferring these assets upon their death to the persons that they're dictating. Now, these are the threshold elements that we look for. Just finished a case last week while Wes was in trial where a beneficiary happened to be a grandchild, an adult grandchild, was a wonderful, wonderful communicator and called into the office. You know, this is a 30-plus, 40-year-old, 30-year-old mm-hmm. grandchild. You know, I'm concerned about my grandmother. The doctors are saying she's got a little bit of forgetfulness and maybe even dementia. They're testing her for that. She's told me that she's going in to see Mr. Harvell to sign a will. But I just kind of, you know, I'm wondering, you know, I don't want anything to happen with grandmother's, signature and, mm-hmm. and right. her ability. Well, what a wonderful thing, because first of all, I would have recognized anyway the elder nature of the client.
Right.
But now there is, you know, a little bird in the room telling us, you know, hey, Cecil, you know, you might want to do a little a further interview with this particular lady in light of this phone call coming in from some of the family members.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, I did interview the grandmother, if you will, and I interviewed her singularly. There was family with her, but I let the family wait out in the lobby so that I could speak with her independently.
Right.
And of course, in speaking with her, here it all comes out. I mean, well, you know, Mr. Harvell, this is the property I own, and you live with your grandchildren right now. Yes, I do, but I have a house, and then the quote on the water,
mm-hmm.
Out in Broad Creek area.
Right,
and that was nice. That kind of goes to, you know, that nature and extent element. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then she's telling me that one of her children, rather than spelling it M-A-R-K, she spells it M-A-R-C.
Right.
That is the way in which that gentleman spells his name. And she corrects the spelling of her relative. She then proceeds to tell me, of course, who her relatives are, this M-A-R-C, plus different other relatives.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly I'm now seeing also the nature and extent of her property, as well as now the objects of her bounty or who her family happens to be. And then, of course, she's telling me how she wants this property to go to certain members of her family and why she wants that to be the disposition of her estate. So, I mean, you know, in a matter of about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, Lockwood, bingo. I mean, this lady is hitting it on all scores. I mean, she's doing just wonderful. And so I was relieved and glad that it didn't have to go further. But that's the kind of thing that my notes would indicate. that's the kind of thing where I would use, you know, not that all of our paralegals are wonderful, but I might use a more experienced paralegal right. in the room as a witness and give them some of the facts and circumstances that they might recall if ever there were an issue. Now, what's interesting, though, about this file is that, as I told you, the family was left in the reception area while I interviewed the elder person. We eventually got the documents all signed, of course, but the family then, even then, had some questions about this, and I thought it was quite wonderful, actually, but I needed to explain to them that, you know, even though there is, the standard is not that our elder loved one be, 25 years
right,
old
right.
and have perfect memory and,
right,
and
right.
not have some lapse in memory. And
yeah.
I think I've heard, you know, I know Wes has mentioned it to me before, you know, everybody has dementia at some point,
uh-huh.
Lockwood.
Right. And that, you know, now you're kind of, you're shaving off a sharp edge, in my opinion, the corner that, just because someone is showing some symptoms of aging, that does not necessarily mean that at the moment of making this decision, they lack the mental capacity to make those decisions. They may lapse, and I'm jumping ahead, and please correct.
Yeah.
They may lapse into forgetfulness later in the afternoon. As a matter of fact, one of the challenges associated with folks of elder age, but also suffering from certain forms of dementia, they have moments of clear lucidity early in the day, and then later in the afternoon, they kind of they get tired for all intents and purposes. So that does not necessarily exclude them from making any changes to their documents if they have those periods of lucidity. Am I thinking correctly?
That's exactly correct, Lockwood. And
wow.
And so even though there are maybe some medical notes, some indicators that the family is concerned about their loved one and maybe some of her forgetfulness and her scatteredness at certain moments, the bottom line is that this lady, for testamentary capacity,
uh-huh.
meets the standard. And the standard is not that we have such a clean bill of health that there's absolutely no note as to our forgetfulness and things of that nature. So the standard is a legal standard. It is not a medical standard. And furthermore, you're absolutely correct, Lockwood, in bringing to this conversation the fact that we all have good days and bad days.
Right. Yeah.
And good moments and bad moments.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it will depend on that. Wes and I, of course, see that kind of those facts of life very often in our office, in that I will see a client on a certain day and they might be very bewildered and kind of emotionally unstable, and then I might see them a week or two later and they're, you know, a whole different person. They're dressed differently, they're presenting, their demeanor is more positive and more appropriate. So yes, we all have good days, bad days, good moments, bad moments. The law does not require for testamentary capacity that we be in any kind of perfect circumstance.
You know,
absolutely, Lockwood, what you're hearing today is that the devil's in the details, and we lawyers have to be very aware of these issues and handle them, you know, with kid leather gloves
right.
in terms of our experience level, which Wes and I both do at this point.
Again, we're talking with, that was Cecil Harvell. We're talking with Harvell and Collins of Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And I do want to remind you the number 252 area code 726-9050. This is an important topic because I know in instances you've got folks that suffer from a variety of problems, addiction, for example, and they do have periods when, quite frankly, they're sober and they can make those decisions. Wes, in the case of court challenges, who has the burden in the case of a challenge of a document, the challenger or the individuals who are presenting the document as being true and accurate?
Well, in almost every case, it's the party who's doing the challenging. They have the burden of proof to show that there was undue influence or lack of capacity at the time of the execution of the document. Under certain circumstances, if we're talking about someone who's a fiduciary and they gets into a different type topic, but under certain, this is kind of in this fiduciary litigation context, under certain circumstances, if you have someone who's a fiduciary, like a power of attorney, an agent under a power of attorney, and you're challenging maybe some act that was taken there, and this really isn't a capacity issue. This is more of you were the power of attorney, you did something to benefit yourself, or you did something that was not to the benefit of the principal, then there's a burden shift there, and the burden then falls upon the person who is the power of attorney who took the act to prove that what they did was not a breach of their fiduciary duty. So it depends on the circumstances, but in this limited kind of box of what we're talking about today, which is execution capacity and lack of undue influence, that's going to be on the burden of the party that's challenging it. So the presumption is the document is good. The presumption is the person who signed it had capacity. The presumption is the person did not was not under undue influence at the time of signing. That's going to be the presumption, and to overcome that, then the challenging party will need to meet that burden of proof with evidence through witnesses, medical records, potentially expert witnesses, as it relates to like the medical records and how this, you know, to explain to a jury, for example, the medical conditions of the person, you know, to put that case together so that the finder of fact, presumably a jury, would be able to make a determination as to whether there was capacity present or whether there was undue influence.
I think this is an important observation on your part in light of the fact that you have just been through a court case on that capacity as the challenger. And so the amount of work, preliminary work to be done in that case is significant. I mean, you're contacting medical representatives or doctors, you've got a lot of research you've got to do then if you're in the challenging or if you're representing the challengers of the document, then don't you?
No doubt about it, and there's plenty of opportunity to try to resolve the case, which we did. We tried to resolve it, tried to work out a settlement, but unfortunately, the party that had benefited from the subject deed did not offer anything prior to trial, so we were forced to try the case, and we won the case. As a result of that, the deed is vamoose. It's gone, like it never existed, and that's what the jury does. I mean, the jury could have gone either way on the case. They went our way. You know, it would have been nice to have been able to work out some kind of resolution a year or so before, because the lawsuit, you know, certainly commenced for well over a year before it was tried. But now the deed is gone, and that's where we are.
Two things. One, it's interesting in light of the fact that the individual that was challenged apparently told an untruth, stating that their lawyer had spoken to the client before their death, and the fact that the work that you did, and the other aspect of all of this, Cecil and Wes, and again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and go back to the very comment you made at the opening, Cecil, the devil is in the details. It's everything. It is detail, 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 or document, 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 right?
That's right, Lockwood. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. I want to thank both of you for this. This is very important. I think we talked about one issue that really caught my attention. That's the subject of lucidity, and then your aspects of the last will and testament, the four items that have necessity to determine their capacity. Again, I want to remind folks, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to give Cecil Harvell or Wes Collins a call at Harvell and Collins. And by the way, that number 252, area code 726-9050, online at harvellandcollins.com. And of course, their location, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And with that, Cecil, Wes, thanks very much for being with us on Let's Talk Legal.
Thank you,
Lockwood.